From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the fallout over the director of the Michigan State Police sharing a Facebook post calling anthem protesters degenerates.
For her to represent the Michigan State Police and to actually call people names because they have an opinion is just totally unacceptable.
The Trump administration rolls back an Obama-era guideline on campus sexual assault, opening fresh debate over how universities handle the problem.
They've inserted themselves into micromanaging the sex lives of anybody that comes in and files a complaint.
Investigative journalists dig up a streak of multiple lottery winners.
There were more than 1,700 people across the United States winning lottery prizes of at least $600 50 times.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. And now the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's universities say they will not immediately implement new federal guidance on campus sexual assault. Last Friday, the Trump administration rescinded the Obama-era guidance on campus sexual assault. The new guidance is not mandatory, and the Education Department says it's temporary until they come up with permanent rules. Daniel Hurley is the CEO of the Michigan Association of State Universities. He says Michigan's universities have been working to improve the culture of sexual assault on campus for years.
But when there are incidents, is to make sure that those both due process is involved as well as victims' rights are adhered to at the highest level.
One part of the new guidance lets schools use a lower standard of evidence when judging accusations of sexual assault. Another allows schools to use mediation for an informal resolution of a sexual assault case. Bloomfield Hills civil rights attorney Deborah Gordon has represented men accused of sexual assault at universities. She has also represented women who have faced workplace and pregnancy discrimination. Deborah Gordon, welcome to the program.
Hello.
So, Deborah, in your view, how big a problem is sexual assault on college campuses?
I think the issue is not so much sexual assault on campus as it is the universities allowing young people to drink way too much alcohol. They do not enforce their rules. You have young college students out there extremely drunk who are engaging in activities they normally would not engage in. I fail to see how it's a sexual assault problem as much as it is a problem of people getting drunk, not keeping their wits about them, and then trying to steer their way through who gave consent when and did I say yes when I really meant no. Depends on your definition of sexual assault, I guess, at the end of the day. A true predator, obviously, can create a significant sexual assault problem. How many true predators are there on these campuses? And if there are, the university admissions department needs to take a very good look at themselves.
So we're really asking a question of who is going to define campus rape?
Well, the law defines campus rape at the end of the day if these cases are being brought pursuant to Title IX and if the university is hiding behind Title IX in taking action, which they are. Title IX bans sexual harassment, and there's a very specific definition of it. With regard to the issue of actual rape on campus, the universities have made up their own rules about what they consider to be sexual assault.
How many clients, Deborah, have you represented who were fighting accusations of campus sexual assault?
I have many clients. I mean, I've had two or three actual cases, one about to be filed, but I've talked to many, many families whose sons' lives are being ruined by what the universities are doing wrong.
There are many instances of and complaints of sexual assault, and I'm getting the sense that you're painting campus sexual assault as mainly a problem of drunken regret by college kids who partied too hard.
That has certainly been my experience with the matters I've looked at. I know what's happening because I've deposed these women, at least in the cases I have. And you would be horrified if you saw the reasons universities are throwing these kids out of school and they literally expel them. You know, it gets down to a matter of, yes, I kept saying yes, but then I changed my mind and I just laid there. And then the boy says, I didn't know she didn't want to have sex. And the university's like, you should have known she was not intoxicated, but incapacitated you're out. And the boy's like, I didn't know. Where is the benefit to society or anybody in that scenario? The university needs to deal with the situation head on by training students and enforcing their alcohol policies. So that's the real issue. Instead, they've inserted themselves into micromanaging the sex lives of anybody that comes in and files a complaint. I mean, I could give you example after example. I have a kid at a major state university who had, according to the female, absolute consensual sex with her in a car over the summer. They continued on for the evening, walking around town. They had been interrupted in their sexual intercourse by somebody that had walked by. Later, they're in a park. He touches her breast. She says, no, I don't want any more sex. He's like, okay, I'll take you home. He does. This is her words. 15 months later, she reports this kid to a state university. They end up creating a permanent record for him that he sexually assaulted her. It's bizarre.
I would call
that a witch hunt. No question about it.
That's one case, and you say you've represented several cases, but we know there are hundreds more instances of sexual assault. How is this view not an oversimplification of the problem?
Hang on. There are not hundreds of more instances of sexual assault. There are hundreds of instances of people coming in and making complaints to the universities for a myriad of reasons about something they didn't like that happened. Do you call a touch of the breast a sexual assault? I mean, I guess in some world, but here it was not. Just because somebody walks into the OIE office, the Office of Institutional Equity, and makes a complaint, that does not mean there are hundreds of instances of sexual assault.
Deborah, before the 2011
change.
Okay.
Let me get to my issue. Whether there's sexual assault on campus or not, I have a much different issue. These state universities are the government. Under our Constitution, you cannot deprive somebody of their property without due process of law. An education at the University of Michigan or Michigan State are considered a property interest by constitutional law. In order to deprive somebody of his interest, you must first give him due process. Here is my issue, Cynthia.
Mm-hmm.
If you are accused of harassing somebody based on his race, if you are accused of starting a fire, if you are accused of breaking into a building, you will get due process. What do I mean by that? You will have a right to a written complaint, and you will have the right to question your accuser. If you are accused of sexual assault, that same right that every other student gets is not allowed to you.
And did that happen since the 2011 changes made by the Obama administration? How were things before those changes?
The same. They're hiding behind the Obama administration. There's nothing in the Obama Dear Colleague letter, nothing, that says you cannot question your accuser. If you read that letter carefully, it's absolutely clear. That letter assumes there's going to be a hearing. And you go to the Department of Ed regs and the Civil Rights Department regs. They all assume there's going to be a hearing. They talk about stuff like, well, at the hearing, perhaps the two don't have to stay in the same room. Yesterday, an opinion came down from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on this very issue that I've been fighting. They found that in a case out of Ohio, the male who was not allowed to put questions to his accuser when credibility was the ultimate issue, it was a he said, she said, he was not allowed to question her, and he was thrown out. The Sixth Circuit said, no way. The greatest way to find truth that's been imagined in the United States is through cross-examination. That kid was deprived of that right, and his constitutional rights were violated.
Deborah, in your view, what would be a better process that would allow universities and college?
It's simple, Cynthia.
Okay. Because you want to make sure students are safe. Also giving the students accused of sexual assault a chance to defend themselves. So what would that look like?
It's simple. It's already done. Follow your same policy for every other thing that creates a lack of safety. Am I safe walking across campus if somebody stops me and robs me, another student? Is that a safety issue? Oh, yes, it is. But if I complain about the robbery, the guy I say robbed me, gets a due process hearing. That's how they need to deal with it. They need to search for the truth. It's no different than any other being put in harm's way. If you're an African-American kid and somebody taunts you and belittles you, you go to a hearing for that. You cannot carve out sexual assault as a separate category and treat it differently from a constitutional point of view than all of these other wrongs that could definitely harm people. So don't talk to me about they want to keep people safe. Everybody wants to keep people safe. But don't come up with your fake world where you say, except for when it's women accused who say they've been sexually assaulted, then you don't have any constitutional rights. That does not stand with me. I'm a civil rights lawyer. Next time, who is it that now doesn't have a right to be heard because the university's created a special category for them?
Deborah, what are your thoughts on Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos' move to roll back the Obama administration's guidance on these issues?
Good. It's something. It's interesting because now people are getting the memo. Wait a minute. People's rights are being violated. People must get notice in writing, which the DeVos interim report does require, and that they should be allowed to cross-examine their accuser in some manner. Those are the pivotal things. So anything that DeVos recommends that's going to move that ball down the field, good for her. It's just making it, you're treating women like babies. Just treat them like you treat every other student. If you make an accusation against somebody, good. Come in and tell your story. Answer questions. Let the truth come out.
But to
put an additional layer of protection over you and treat you like you're an infant. And you can't be expected to answer questions, but we're going to expel this kid. I mean, that's just a nightmare for a civil rights lawyer.
Attorney Deborah Gordon, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You heard Deborah Gordon talk about yesterday's Sixth Circuit Court decision in the case of Doe v. University of Cincinnati. The Federal Appeals Court ruled on Monday. So just to be clear, we spoke with Deborah Gordon on Tuesday morning. Coming up tomorrow, we'll hear a different view on campus sexual assault, and we'll speak with the co-authors in an opinion piece in the New York Times who asked the question, who gets to define campus rape?
When you dismiss all of these charges as they're simply just about women drinking too much, it misses the way that alcohol is used as a date rape drug.
That will be tomorrow right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does it take to get information about the Michigan lottery, particularly whether there are repeat winners, folks winning over and over and over again at incredibly long odds? That's one question a team of investigative journalists has been exploring for the Columbia Journalism Review. They examined state lotteries across the country and discovered frequent odds-defying winners are certainly out there to be identified if the state coughs up lottery records under the Freedom of Information Act. Here in Michigan, that proved to be challenging. One of the team is with us now. Jeff Kelly Lowenstein is an investigative journalist and author. He's an assistant professor of journalism at Grand Valley State University. Jeff, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Really appreciate the chance to talk about the work. Thank you.
Well, this all started in 2014 in Florida with a writer for the Palm Beach Post and has blown up to where you and your colleagues have found a number of fishy lottery results across the country. When we say frequent winners, Jeff, I mean, how frequent? Give us some examples.
What we did was, as you said, we built on the previous investigation that Lawrence Maurer did at the Palm Beach Post. He got 20 years worth of winners' data and found that there were some people winning as much as 200, 250 times, as you were saying, just incredibly low odds. I was working at Columbia Journalism School, and the other authors on the article, a number of them are my former students. We found that journalists in about a dozen states had replicated the analysis. We got data for New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut for the class, and then a colleague that we were working with in Pennsylvania got Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And so at that point, we said, you know, we've got 19 states, there are 45 lotteries. Let's find out how widespread this is across the entire country. So we wrote Freedom of Information Act requests for every lottery in the country. We got data for 36 out of the 45 lotteries, including D.C. And what we found was that there were more than 1,700 people across the United States winning lottery prizes of at least $600, a minimum of 50 times. Now, that was the minimum level. We also found people in Massachusetts. There was one gentleman who won more than 7,300 times from 2011 to 2016. So for 1 year, for instance, that was about four times a day. So the range of winning, it happened all over the country at least 50 times, but some people won just enormous amounts of time.
It's mind-blowing to me. I think once in my life I've maybe won $5 or $10 with a scratch-off. So this is quite stunning. Any clues as to how, for example, somebody could be winning on an average of four times a day?
Well, it's important to say that just winning a lot by itself doesn't mean that something untoward is happening. And a number of the winners that we did meet and get to talk with said, oh, I just play an awful lot. If I've won $1.5 million, I've lost $4.5 million, and that kind of thing. That is important to say that it is possible, but the initial analysis was that the statistical odds of that happening in many cases are just incredibly low. The gentleman in Florida, Lawrence Maurer, and other reporters found instances of a number of different things. One was what's called discounting. For instance, if I owe child support and I win a lottery ticket for $1,000, and you're a retailer, I would pay you $100 to cash in that ticket for me, because otherwise all my money would go straight to taxes. So the lottery win would go under your name. You would get $100 and I would get $900. In a number of states, the tax issues are such that you wouldn't actually be responsible for much of a tax burden. So that's one example. We also heard in Florida, Lawrence Maurer found instances where people who are undocumented went in to cash their ticket, and the retailer said, well, we can cash it, but if we do, you know, immigration's going to find out about it. Oh, no, that's okay. Here you go. Here's the ticket. We also learned about instances where if I cashed in a ticket and you were the retailer, you might say, oh, congratulations, you won the $5 or $10 that you mentioned earlier, when in fact the ticket was, let's just say, $600.
Hmm.
The other thing that we heard, we didn't have direct reporting of this, but we did hear, was money laundering. And so folks who want to make their money clean, let's say they have $10 million, they play the lottery a bunch of times. If it returns 60, 65%, they lose several million dollars, but now it's clean money. So we heard about three or four different ways. And in fact, while we were reporting the project, there was a project in Iowa by the Des Moines Register, which found different examples of fraud, such as I've just described, that then the state didn't really follow up on. So that wasn't our reporting, but that was very fine reporting by the Des Moines Register.
Interesting. This is a two-pronged conversation, because there's the story of these, you know, multiple winners, and also the story of the response that you got from various states when you submitted your FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, asking for data. And certainly much variation throughout the state. And for a benchmark, you gave Florida and Oregon the Service with a Smile Award. Why was that?
Well, Florida has some of the best open records laws in the country, and so as soon as we asked, they popped the data, they gave it in the CD, they sent it right along to us as many years as we wanted. Oregon, they gave one of our team members, John Alsop, a downloadable link. We got the data real quickly. The data was clean. It didn't require a bunch of time to kind of make sense of it. They were excellent. They were excellent. There were other states that were also very good, but Florida and Oregon really stood out.
And then you have a number of other cleverly worded awards, the Come and Get It Award going to New Hampshire, who the representative said, yeah, you can come and get the records. They're in paper form in my office. As for Michigan, it was the Send Me the Bill Award. And why was that?
Yeah, Michigan, we initially began that effort, Cynthia, when I was teaching my first semester at Grand Valley last fall. So I submitted the Freedom of Information Act request, and the gentleman from that office, from the agency, asked me if we could speak. So I said that was fine.
And what was the request? Just so we understand, we're all on the same page. What were you asking?
We were asking for sales by retailer by year, so we could see where the money was being spent. You can do some interesting analysis on that. But then we also wanted the first and last names of winners' data for as many years as they had, so that then we could do the kind of analysis that we were able to carry out in states across the country.
Okay.
So that's what we asked for. So in regards to that second request, when the gentleman from Michigan contacted me, he explained it would take more than 2.5 million hours to carry out the request. So we calculated that if they took literally no hours off, that the earliest we would get the information was in 2401.
Okay, then. So don't hold your breath if that's the case.
Well, that's where we said we resisted the temptation to say, why don't you get started and send me the bill when you're done?
And then, again, keep in mind, you know, Oregon and Florida sent the downloadable link and a CD within hours of a request. So we're just keeping that in mind. So then what happened?
I pushed on it, and I just said, look, and I cited some of the other states. We hadn't gone as far as we later did with the project, but I did say, look, this is completely unreasonable. We have to have this data. It's public data. We've gotten it from other states, and we want it. And so then, and I also insisted that they put it in writing. I actually showed the students at Grand Valley, this is what they're saying it would take. So I pushed on, and then they came back a few days later and said, all right, we can actually get you the data in 3 days for free.
In 3 days?
Three days for free. So we were excited about that. The thing was, that was a little challenging, was the agency decided to invoke a provision of Michigan Freedom of Information Law so that they gave us the first names of the winners, but not the last names. And so ultimately, that rendered the data useless for any meaningful analysis. So, for example, we're here in the Grand Rapids area. It would say, John, Grand Rapids. Well, as you know, there could be 50 different Johns. So we pushed on that. We didn't have much success, but it is something that we've looked into revisiting and trying to get that data because we got it from so many other states.
In the piece that you all wrote for the Columbia Journalism Review, I note that was an optional provision of the Michigan privacy law they invoked.
Correct. That was a point that I made with the gentleman who was both in writing and on the phone when we spoke. That, you know, you don't have to do that. We've gotten it from other states. It's public information. We want it from Michigan, but as you said, they chose to invoke the optional provision. So that part of the analysis, we weren't really able to do too much in a meaningful way in Michigan as compared to other states. But as I said, we're coming back to revisit that, and we do want to try and get that data.
Yeah, so just to be clear, given what you've had so far, there's no way to tell if there's anyone out there gaming Michigan's lottery.
Correct, yeah, because it could say Cynthia in Ann Arbor. And maybe you, Cynthia, have won 200 times, but maybe you've won once, as you said, for $5, and then there's another Cynthia who's won 20, another one 180. We can't tell because there's not the last name. So at this point, Michigan really stands out, both in terms of the process, but also once actually producing the data, as being one of the less publicly available states. And that's why we tried to make it kind of fun in the article by having awards. But Michigan did stand out that way as being a bit difficult in terms of the public access to information.
Jeff Kelly Lowenstein, investigative journalist, author, and assistant professor of journalism at Grand Valley State University. And once again, if you want to check out that website looking at the national and international lottery picture, you can go to gamingthelottery.org. Fascinating stuff, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And a note, we talked with a Michigan Lottery spokesman who pointed out that it is illegal under Michigan law to release the full names of people who win more than $10,000 on a state-only game. The spokesman also said the Michigan Lottery has an internal system to prevent fraudulent winners from claiming prizes and agreed to have an official join us next week to explain how that system works. You can hear an extended version of our interview with Jeff Lowenstein, in which he talks more in depth about the global lottery industry. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Leaping from branch to branch, burying nuts and acorns, teasing a backyard dog by staying just out of reach. Let's face it, squirrels are so common in Michigan, it's easy for us to take their presence for granted. But just as Holden Caulfield worried about where the ducks go in winter, we got to wondering, where do squirrels go during winter? Do they cluster up in some hibernation hole or perhaps join Michigan's snowbirds and head towards warmer locales? It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And with us today, State Archivist Mark Harvey. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
The observation of squirrels, I guess, have been going on since there were humans here in this region. But do we know when the first written account was?
Well, I tried to go as far back as I could on this one. That usually leads me to looking at the Jesuit relations, and they actually talk about squirrels and the squirrel nation or the squirrel tribe in 1651 in New France. Now, that's a little further north than we currently are, but it's in the general region of Lower Ontario. Lewis and Clark also wrote about them in 1803, swimming the Ohio River, headed south, and then we have lots of written references after that in Michigan proper.
In fact, people observed some pretty intense and huge squirrel migrations. Tell us about those.
Well, I don't know where to start, Cynthia.
That's an unusual topic.
It is.
And I mean, even the idea of, as you say, Lewis and Clark observing squirrels swimming across the river in great amounts. And so where were these chatterboxes migrating from, where to where?
There's all sorts of accounts of them. It starts with some 19th century accounts in Michigan where people relied on them as a source of food and then clothing because there were so many of them. They literally had to beat them back with clubs. There's actually a written account that farmers were forced to harvest squirrels in order to protect their crops and barns, up to killing up to 20,000 squirrels within a week.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty heavy. So for food and clothing, a very rich source for these early settlers.
Yep.
And then what about these migrations and going across the river? And even after the Mackinac Bridge opened, did I understand that the squirrels would be walking across the bridge?
Yeah. So starting in 1851, the residents of Holland, Michigan, dubbed it the year of the squirrel, quote unquote, because the squirrels were just devastating their crops and gardens in biblical proportion. And then there's accounts in 1866 in the Saginaw Valley, 1922 in decades after up at the Straits, and then 1986 on the Garden Peninsula in the UP, 2004 in Grand Haven. So you mentioned the bridge. There was a gentleman up there, a Uper named Don Densmore, that started noticing them in 1922 trying to swim north across the Straits, which is a perilous swim under the best of circumstances.
So not an entirely successful swim by these squirrels, I must imagine.
No, the swim range is around, for a squirrel, is around 2 miles. Mm. And the birds would harass him, and so maybe some made it, but most of them just drowned and washed back up on shore. And then they got wise, because in 1957, the year the bridge opened, they saw that span as a way to cross the water without swimming. And it got to be such a problem that bridge workers had to, quote-unquote, remove them, which probably usually meant shooting them off the bridge to keep them from being a traffic hazard. So it's hard enough for a motorist to cross that bridge without dodging squirrels. And I don't know, you know, it's been a while since I've been on the Labor Day bridge walk, so maybe they're inconspicuously trying to work their way into that event.
Do we know when the last big squirrel migration was in Michigan?
The last recorded one that was reported was the one in 2004 in Grand Haven, Michigan. And there was lots of confusion initially over that because people found dozens of dead squirrels floating in the Grand River and washing up on the Lake Michigan beaches. And officials thought there was a disease issue or maybe a mass poisoning, but all the lab reports came back negative and it was determined they had just drowned.
Were they trying to get away from winter? Were they trying to come back here when the weather was warm? What do we think was going on with these big migrations?
So I talked to the Michigan DNR biologist, Adam Bump, and pretty much put the question to him. And he said the word migration really needs air quotes around it, because that usually implies movement due to weather over long distances. And what, as near as they can tell, the phenomenon is pretty much the province of the gray squirrel. And the best explanation is that during food abundance, the squirrel populations increase to a point that depletes all their resources and or triggers a behavior to get them to move on to greener pastures.
Hmm. Okay. And the point that you make about gray squirrels leads me to wonder just how many types of squirrels make their home in Michigan. And the reason I'll ask this is I grew up in Oakland County in Ferndale, southern Oakland County, and all we ever had were those little like reddish orange squirrels. And my first big job out of college, 1976, I was over in Grosse Pointe, and I went, look at these black squirrels. We never had them in Ferndale, but they've moved because now if you drive through Ferndale, they are there. So how many kinds of squirrels do we have?
It's a bit of a trick question because squirrels covers everything from a woodchuck to chipmunks to other types of ground squirrels to flying squirrels. Which are flying squirrels or a type of tree squirrel. So I think most people commonly, when they speak of a squirrel, they're thinking of a tree squirrel. And
yes,
in Michigan, there's three main ones. The red squirrel, which you mentioned, which are a little bit smaller. Some people call them boomers because they're so loud.
Okay.
The fox squirrel and the gray squirrel.
So is the black squirrel that I saw in Grosse Pointe when I first started working, is that actually the gray squirrel?
Yeah, that is a black phase gray squirrel. And I have to tell you, whenever I correct somebody on that, no one appreciates the difference at that. And I grew up in East Lansing, and there was a very distinct pocket of them in East Lansing. And if you went a few miles to the west in Lansing, you would not see them. So I think they're just pocketed around the state with that black color factor.
There we go. So back to the original question, where do Michigan squirrels go during the winter?
Well, actually, nowhere. They don't hibernate. They just hang out eating their cache of food, trying to stay warm and not driving each other nuts.
There you go, or us as well.
Yeah.
Well, that is it. All you ever wanted to know about squirrels going nuts here in Michigan. Mark Harvey, State Archivist with the Michigan History Center. Thank you so much for biting into this nut of squirrel migration.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Still to come, how does it feel to be a DACA recipient these days?
It's sort of like this desperation of wanting to have an answer as to what's going to come next, but just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The director of the Michigan State Police has apologized for sharing a Facebook post calling NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem, I quote here, degenerates. The Michigan Black Legislative Caucus is demanding Governor Snyder fire Colonel Christy Kebby Achu. The black lawmakers say they are appalled by the post, but Governor Snyder says he will not ask her to resign, citing her decades of public service. With us now, Jack Hall. In August 1967, he became the first African-American Michigan State Police trooper, and he helped to recruit women and minority troopers. He retired as a captain in 1992. Jack, what do you make of the director of the Michigan State Police seemingly calling on people who choose to kneel during the anthem to protest the unequal treatment of African Americans by law enforcement, ingrates, and degenerates?
My take on that might be different than other people. She has a right to her opinion, but she does not have a right to call somebody a degenerate or derelict or anything like that. She has a right to her opinion, but not to call people names.
And the idea that it's posted on social media, even though this is supposedly just for friends?
That would make it even worse. And again, she is representing the state of Michigan as the director of the Michigan State Police, which I serve with, and I just love the Michigan State Police. Overall, it's a fine organization. For her to represent the Michigan State Police and to actually call people names because they have an opinion is just totally unacceptable.
Jack, during your years at the Michigan State Police, the Justice Department sued the department. That was in 1975, alleging discrimination against minorities and women. There was certainly the federal consent decree until 1993, monitoring the department's hiring of minority troopers. And after the consent decree was lifted, it seemed the numbers of minority troopers started to decline to the point where in 2015, the Detroit Free Press reported there were 59 black troopers among the more than 1,100 statewide. What happened?
I think what happened is that, and again, I think this is probably not only a state, but I think this is nationwide. When they lifted the consent decree, I think the people took their eye off the ball. And my take on that is that I think the people became complacent and saying that, okay, the state police has satisfied what we were ordered to do. Therefore, we do not have to recruit blacks, Hispanics, women, or whatever. But I got to tell you right now, I don't know many blacks, Hispanics, or whatever, including myself, that law enforcement was on their bucket list. It was not on my bucket list. I got into law enforcement because I was looking for a job which had some stability. Once I got into law enforcement, then I wanted to better myself. The only thing I knew about police officers, they screwed with people. They messed with people for no reason. And I think this is true to a lot of young blacks that lived in a segregated situation, is that law enforcement was just not our friend. And so you just never aspire to be a police officer on any police department, state police included.
And I know in your time with the MSP, you spent a lot of time recruiting new troopers. So
Right. You
were hearing this firsthand.
Right. Now, one thing, my recruitment was a little bit different perhaps than other people. I would go to universities, I would go to high schools and whatever, and I'd ask a young fellow, why don't you come into the state police? No, I do not want to be a police officer, and definitely I want to be state police, period. I said, why not? Because they mess with people. They beat on people. I said, let me ask you something. Out of all of the things that you've seen where young blacks have been assaulted by police for no reason or whatever, do you know anything about salt and pepper? Oh, yeah, salt and pepper is something you put on your salad or whatever. No. A salt and pepper team. No, I can't think I know that concept. Well, salt and pepper team is this. If you have a black officer and a white officer working together, Have you ever seen these two officers assault a black guy or assault a white guy? It very seldom happens. I said, well, I never thought of that concept. I said, well, it works. The more blacks you have on the department, the less likely you're going to get a situation where a police officer, whether it's black or white, going to overreact towards somebody that looks differently than he does or she does. Because they understand perhaps where the person is coming from. So they're yelling or screaming or whatever. A black person, hey, the guy doesn't mean any harm by it. He's just, you know, just reacting. And more than likely, they're not going to exacerbate the situation. They're going to be more tolerant of what's going on. And I was really successful, not only myself, but we got a lot of young blacks, Hispanics, women, whatever, in the recruiting effort. And we did a super job. And like you say, the numbers you're talking about, when I left the state police, we was just either just under or just over 200 black officers in the state police, African Americans in the state police. Within 10 years, we're down to 59, I think. I'm thinking, what happened?
And Colonel Etchew has said she wants to see diversity among the ranks improve. How do you think that Facebook post is going to affect the MSP effort to attract more qualified black candidates?
Well, I think it's going to curtail it, because you can say anything you want to, but you got to look and see what the person is doing. And basically my concern is that I have no idea what you say you're going to do. I'm just looking at what you did, and I looked at something like 8 schools, which they average probably 70, 80, 90, sometimes over 100 off. They had 8 schools, which would be around 800 people. Out of the 800 recruits starting, they had less than 20 African-Americans starting and probably a similar number of females and other ethnic minorities. So I challenged her that, is that what happened? She had no answer. She said, well, we've been recruiting. Well, you should have looked and saw what we did. Maybe you can mimic that and do the same thing we did back when under Colonel Davis.
And then based now knowing what was posted by Colonel Etchew this weekend, how do you think that's going to go with recruitment?
Well, I think it's going to definitely curtail, because you might have a young black or Hispanic or female or whatever that's seriously thinking about coming to the state police. And they either hear or see what she said, they're going to say, this is wrong. I really don't know if I want to work for an organization that condones this type of behavior on the part of the person that's running the organization. But again, that's my opinion. And I would, if I was betting, I would say it's going to have a negative effect on recruiting on minorities.
Jack Hall, the first African-American to become a Michigan State Police trooper. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Jack.
And thank you.
The Michigan State Police did not respond to our request to speak with Colonel Etchew. We also reached out to the Michigan State Police Troopers Association, and they declined to comment. Most Americans say they want to protect the Dreamers, those undocumented immigrants brought here as children. President Trump has announced he's phasing out the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, and he gave Congress 6 months to come up with a replacement. 3 GOP senators have just announced details of their reform plan, the SUCCEED Act. It spells out steps for receiving conditional status in the U.S., including maintaining gainful employment or pursuing higher education classes or military service. Ultimately, holders of this status could apply for a green card. Meantime, as Congress talks for DACA recipients, these are times of stress and uncertainty. Maria Ibarra Frere got her DACA status in 2012. She is with the Washtenaw Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights and is a recent graduate from the University of Michigan Masters of Social Work program. Maria, pleasure to welcome you here. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How old were you when you came to the U.S.?
I was 9 years old.
What do you remember about the journey? What'd you go through to get here?
Yeah, so we came initially to visit my dad, who had been living here for about 4 years prior to us arriving. So it was myself, my brother, and my mom. And we came on a tourist visa to visit him. And what I remember the most is just how much easier life was here than in Mexico, and what it was like to have two parents who were around and being able to be in a stable environment.
And there you were as an intact family.
Yes.
And as you grew into your teen years, what was it like for you before you were able to get your DACA status? What were you not able to do?
It was very lonely. During this time, it was before this whole undocumented youth movement was bubbling, and I was very afraid to tell anyone that I was undocumented. I didn't tell not even my best friends. And when it was time to apply for a driver's license, I just kept putting it off and off and never really gave anyone an answer about why I couldn't. the most difficult part was applying for college. And I love school. I always tell people that school saved me because I was a very shy child. And having that school component to rely on to boost my confidence was really what encouraged me and helped me sort of blossom. And the reality that I probably was not going to be able to go to college because at this time, most schools charged you out-of-state tuition if you were undocumented. And I also wasn't eligible for financial aid. So this left me with a $40,000 per year tuition charge that there was no way that my parents would be able to help me pay for that. So it was frustrating. It was isolated. I was ashamed of being undocumented. I always felt like it was something to be under the table. We never talked about it. We try to keep it from anyone that wasn't close family.
And then how did announcement of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program hit you when that came down in 2012?
It was a shock, and it was hard to believe. It was announced in June of 2012, and then it was going to be implemented starting August. And I remember for those 2 months sort of being in disbelief and not really allowing myself to accept that I could have a work permit, that I would be able to have a driver's license, because I was so afraid that something would happen. The whole thing was like, I'm not going to believe it until it's in my hands.
Was this a feeling like I get to step out into the light?
It was a feeling of we worked for this. You know, everyone has the notion that President Obama gave us DACA, but in reality, we demanded it. And we worked really hard, and we engaged in civil disobedience and actions and worked for this. It wasn't anything that was just handed down to us.
How did life change after you got DACA status?
It became so much easier. I was able to get a driver's license, get a Social Security number, which just makes everything from going to the doctor to applying for a job just so much easier.
And the tuition issue had been dealt with, had it not?
It had, yes. Mm-hmm. But so I was actually able to go to college while being undocumented because I applied to go to a private school that had the same rate for everyone. And I was able to get a pretty good scholarship based on that. So I was fortunate enough that when DACA was announced, I had already graduated from college, and I was doing a program that didn't require me to have a Social Security number. I was doing a year of service. And DACA coming to us in 2012 was just sort of like the perfect timing, because once I finished this program, I would have to figure out what I was doing. And having the opportunity to get a job after my program ended was just, it makes everything so much easier.
And tell us about your job.
So I currently work as a community organizer for the Washtenaw ID Project.
Which is what?
Which is a local government-issued county ID that is available for all residents in Washtenaw County. And this is especially helpful for people who are undocumented or people who, for some reason, can't access a state ID. A lot of people, particularly a lot of older adults and African Americans who don't have a birth certificate because their births were never recorded. So they still can't access the state ID. So we have this sort of notion that this Washington ID is only for undocumented immigrants, but it helps so many more people than that.
In these days since President Trump stood up and said, we are phasing out DACA, how have you been feeling?
It's a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. The day after the election, I stayed home and I cried and it's sort of like this like desperation of wanting to have an answer as to what's going to come next, but just waiting for the other shoe to drop and knowing that in any moment I could be at risk of deportation. Immigration has everything they need to know about me. They have my name. They know where I live. They know where I've lived for the past 5 years. They have my fingerprints. They have my picture. They have everything they need to know about me and could come for me at any moment and could come for all the other undocumented people who have DACA. So it's a lot of anxiety, stress. This year, I really have felt this anxiety that I didn't feel before when I was undocumented, like not being able to sleep, getting ill more often than I used to. To the point where I've like actually have gone to see a therapist because I really feel very overwhelmed.
When you hear the president say, "We love the Dreamers"?
It's confusing because what he's saying and what he's doing are two opposite things. But it also speaks, I think, to this narrative that we created around the concept of dreamers, people who are innocent, who we defer all the blame to their parents, and who have worked hard, who have assimilated, who in every way fit into this criteria that we impose on immigrants. And they represent what we want everyone to that comes into the U.S. to do. And that's really problematic because we're throwing our parents under the bus. We are criminalizing people that don't fit into this criteria simply because they came here at a different age or because they don't speak English. So it really shows the ways in which the U.S. wants to create this separation between the deserving immigrant and the not deserving immigrant. And
yet you know, people will say, but there are rules, mm-hmm. and they didn't follow the rules, mm-hmm. so there are consequences
of course.
For that. What do you say when you hear that?
Mm-hmm. We often talk about, why didn't they wait in line? Why didn't they go through the process? Well, the waiting in line takes years. It actually takes decades. I would willingly apply and wait it out to be able to gain lawful status in the U.S., but there isn't an actual application for me. So unless I had an immediate U.S. citizen relative, and that can only be a parent, child, or a spouse, there isn't a way for me to gain legal status. There's no hook or any sponsor. So that's the major problem. And people do not leave their country unless they're being chased out. No one willingly submits themselves to being ridiculed, to be treated as less than a human, unless their conditions in their home country are really, really horrible. So allowing ourselves to have a little more sympathy and empathy and welcoming people who are running away from terrible situations that we may never understand, but also knowing that no one does this unless they absolutely have to.
When you hear about Congress looking for something to give to the president before the 6 month, we just had this Succeed mm-hmm. Act that was offered up by Republican Senators Tom Tillis, James Lankford, and Orrin Hatch. So this is something they've come mm-hmm. up with an idea. What is your hope? What would you mm-hmm. like to see us? A clean standalone mm-hmm. bill?
I would, yes. We're demanding for a clean version of, if you want to call it a Succeed Act, you want to call mm-hmm. it a Dream Act, whatever name you want to give it.
And by that you mean you're not going to punish my parents or you're
not. Exactly. Right. You're not going to attach it to funding for a wall. You're not going to add more community enforcement by immigration. You're not going to hike up the punishment that people have to receive if somehow they came after or before.
Can you understand why Democrats are going to have to do some bargaining to make something happen, which means compromise, which means not everybody gets what they want?
I do understand that. But I also remember that in 2010, we had Democrats who voted against the DREAM Act, and it was a standalone bill. Perhaps if they had taken different choices, we wouldn't be where we are now. So undocumented young people shouldn't have to pay the consequence of the Democrats who weren't courageous enough to do the right thing to begin with.
Do you let yourself think about what might happen if Congress does not agree on something and the end of the 6 months, the president says, well, Dreamers, we love you, but you've got to go?
Yeah, I do. I try not to, but it's hard not to think about it and hard not to have a plan B. And I keep reminding myself that I've been undocumented before and I know what that's like. And I am stronger now than I was when I was 18 and I was undocumented. And I don't have a plan B at the moment. Right now, my focus is to try to do everything that I can so it won't get to that point.
Maria Ibarra-Freyer, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your experience with DACA.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening.